Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and today my guest is Alex Wright, manager of the Fidelity Special Values Investment Trust and the Fidelity Special Situations Fund, which principally invests in the UK in both small and larger companies. Alex, thanks for joining me. Due to train strikes, you can't be in this studio with me, but you're talking from your home in Essex, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I guess as we've done many times, unfortunately, over the last couple of years, I'm working from home today. But it is nice to see I'm generally in the office sort of 3 or 4 days a week under
Fantastic.
Normal circumstances.
And I was interested to see from a video on the Fidelity website that when you're not working, you like to, and you're at home, you like to relax in the garden. Is that the case?
Yeah, so I wouldn't describe myself as a keen gardener because I don't really get the time to do so, but it's something I very much enjoy. And obviously living a bit out of town, we've got the opportunity to have a decent amount of open space.
Now, that sounds great. Well, listen, let's focus on your core job. And you've run Fidelity Special Values Trust for over a decade. And so it's good to hear from you because we're talking against a backdrop clearly of heightened economic and political uncertainty. But over the 10 years to the end of August, your trust has delivered a total return of 209% to shareholders, and that's way ahead of the 93% from the FTSE All Share. So I'm wondering, what message or lessons does its strong performance against the UK stock market and against its sector and rivals carry for investors in these uncertain times?
Yeah, so it's obviously a great milestone to have gone through the 10-year anniversary on the trust. And I suppose when you look back, a lot of very unexpected things have happened during that 10 years, be they sort of the Brexit vote, Donald Trump getting elected, the COVID pandemic and shutdowns. And clearly, I wouldn't have predicted any of those back in 2012 when we took on the trust. So I think volatile times is something we very much lived with during this period and unexpected events. And I think actually the sort of the opportunity that those throw up often actually leads to great returns. So while you've seen several significant drawdowns in the trust and markets during that period, they've all in retrospect turned out to be great buying opportunities that have allowed us to pick up stock specific stories that people have overlooked in the sort of more general panic. And so I think investors, certainly when they have a 3 to 5 year horizon, which I think investors in the trust should do, and that's the horizon we very much take, see these opportunities for performance and not panic when we see the volatility, be it geopolitical or economic.
Yeah, I mean, investors have certainly had to put up with a lot, as you say, in the past decade. Do you think investors broadly have got better at kind of, you know, resisting the urge to panic sell and get out at the bottom?
Unfortunately, no, I don't think that's the case. And if anything, there's some factors which have grown over the last 10 years in terms of sort of programmatic trading and CTA trading, hedge fund trading. A lot of that is very momentum driven. So actually, if anything, it reinforces some of those traditional biases of human investors. And so the volatility of markets sort of on a macro level has got bigger. So while you could say some of maybe these algorithm computers on a micro level maybe iron out sort of intra-sector or stock-specific sort of news, on a macro level, I think they actually magnify it. So that opportunity to go against the market has actually got greater over the last 10 years, not less.
But you do have to hold your nerve, it sounds. We should clarify before we go much further, what is the difference? Is there any difference between Special Values Investment Trust and Special Situations Fund?
So the funds are very similar. They're about 95% the same. And the key difference is a slightly higher average level of gearing for special values. So both funds have the ability to gear, but the typical gearing limit, typical gearing level on special values be about 10%, whereas it'd be more like sort of 3 to 4% on special situations. And we tend to invest that extra sort of 5 to 7% of the fund in some more micro cap names. So both funds have quite a strong mid and small cap bias. Indeed, 60% of both funds are sub 5 billion, which is where we sort of do the cutoff between sort of large and mid and small. But we have a bucket of the fund, about 5% in sort of more micro cap sub 200 million pound names in special values.
I see. So the investment trust can do even more in those smaller companies. Actually, that's interesting because you made your name as a fund manager with the Fidelity UK Smaller Companies Fund, which a couple of years ago you passed to your co-manager, Jonathan Winton. But I'm wondering from what you're saying, in your heart, are you still essentially a small cap stock picker?
So definitely I enjoy the small cap part of the market, and it's obviously just over the majority of the fund, so 60% of the fund. But I think there's opportunities right across the market cap spectrum. So a lot of the names that I am really excited about, the banking names, the life insurance names, they tend to only really exist in the large cap part of the market. So I think there is, if you just look at one part of the market, you obviously reduce your total opportunity set. So I like the fact we have flexibility across everything in the UK market, and obviously up to 20% overseas as well.
Yeah. Now, looking forward, there's a consensus, it would seem, that the next 10 years will be very different because of high inflation and interest rates. Do you agree we've entered a new era? And what are the implications that investors should consider?
So it's really difficult, as I guess we go back to the initial question, sort of you wouldn't have predicted what was going to happen over the last 10 years, 10 years ago. And so it's extremely difficult to make a prediction for the next 10 years at this point. I think what you do have to look back, though, is actually if you look at long term history, the last 10 years of incredibly low interest rates, incredibly low inflation, very low and volatile economic growth, that's actually quite an aberration over history. I don't believe there's been any 50, it's pretty much been a 15-year period of that. You've seen short periods of that historically, but never a 15-year period before. And obviously, you've never seen the degree of sort of unconventional monetary policy like quantitative easing used either. So I think the next 10 years, it's difficult to say exactly how it will look, but I think it's extremely unlikely to look like the last period, because that was an extremely unusual period. So normally, if you look back at all the academic literature and long-term market returns, value outperforms, but because you generally see real discount rates reversion to mean, and you don't see these unusual conditions. So I think actually the next 10 years is likely to be a lot better for value versus growth than it has been.
So maybe we just say a word about value. So your investment approach is a value style. You're buying companies when they're cheap and out of favour, but obviously looking for companies that you think are good that will recover. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'd sort of we class it a value contrarian approach. So effectively looking at things other people aren't looking at. And the reason we do that, and the reason that has worked really well over the fund's lifetime from 1979, is that effectively, if you buy something that you think is good, but most people think it isn't, effectively, if you're wrong, you don't lose that much money because everyone thought the company wasn't great anyway. But if actually it turns out you're right, a lot more people come round to your point of view and they look to buy the stock and drive up the rating. It's actually exactly the opposite of what happens in a growth stock. Like if you buy a stock that everyone thinks is great and it turns out to be great, well, that's what the stock was already priced for. But if you're wrong, you lose a lot of money on the downside. So that's why I like being a value investor, because it skews your risk reward. You don't have to have a really high batting average and get it right every time, because when you get it right, the returns are much better than when you get it wrong.
Yeah. There's a lot of sort of, kind of common sense sort of wrapped up in that definition. But, value investing has had a difficult time. I mean, it's coming good since the pandemic, perhaps. But and although, you know, your 10-year performance shows that it's worked. Yeah. But I just wondered, what do you think you've done different, maybe from other value style fund managers? Because, quite a few of them got carried out, basically, are no longer running funds because, performance wasn't good enough in that growth, strong growth era. What were you doing? I mean, you've had difficult years. There's no denying that. But what have you done that's enabled you to avoid that kind of really bad underperformance?
I think it's about the stock picking ability of the fund. So while we pick in that same value pool that, you're right, Gavin, has underperformed the market over the the 10-year period that we've been on the fund, we don't have to buy every stock in that value pool. So we're highly selective in what we own. And what we've done a lot of avoiding is value traps that have bad balance sheets. So effectively, we want to think about what happens if we get it wrong. The good news is there isn't generally much valuation downside if we get it wrong. But if the balance sheet of the company we've bought is bad and there's debt on the balance sheet and the earnings miss, that's where you can lose an awful lot of money. So effectively, we're always trying to minimize the chance of permanent capital loss. And the easiest way to get permanent capital loss is to have too much debt. And so definitely versus other value funds, we run lower levels on average of debt within our companies. And therefore, we have had failures. We haven't lost a lot of money, whereas that has tripped up some of my peers.
I see. Well, that is interesting, because I was going to ask you, because you're saying, you know, this era of higher interest rates, higher inflation, you know, is one that's conducive to the style, but I was going to value style. But, with government bonds indicating interest rates should be around 4%, you know, I was wondering, you know, in terms of, you know, the increased finance costs for some of those companies, that could, what impact that would be having on those kind of companies you're buying, but you're deliberately buying ones that aren't too indebted.
Yeah, so to be honest, the reason for not having the debt to companies, as we talk about, is risk. But obviously, in this kind of environment where interest rates are rising, having higher levels of debt is also bad for your earnings. And then obviously, high levels of interest rate is bad for valuations as well. So I think having a value fund, which has a low PE, lower than the market, and that has lower debt, is an ideal place to be, because you don't get that valuation risk and all that earnings risk as well.
Yeah. Now, the UK market, stock market, has been comparatively resilient this year. I think down, notwithstanding the falls after the recent budget, down about 8% for the year by early October. So does that mean UK equities are less of a bargain compared to their international counterparts?
So UK equities started the year a lot cheaper than their international peers. So I think you've got to bear that in mind. And then also you've got to think about the big currency moves we've had this year as well. So actually 80% of the earnings of the UK market don't come from the pound. They come from other currencies. And with the pound down sort of 15 to 20% versus the dollar, if you look at the performance of the UK market in dollar terms, it's actually pretty similar to other markets. So the UK's remained as cheap as it was at the start of the year. So that bargain status that we've been talking about for a while definitely hasn't gone away.
Okay. And are you structuring the portfolios or positioning them in a different way, you know, with this sort of new era idea in mind?
No. So again, I think that the next 10 years will almost certainly look different from the last 10. Exactly how it will look, I think, is difficult. And also, I would be surprised to see inflation at the kind of levels, the sort of 10% levels we're seeing on average for the next 10 years. And indeed, markets are not predicting that. They're predicting actually inflation to come back down reasonably quickly to the 2 to 3% range. So the environment, it's going to be difficult to tell exactly what it's looked like. So actually we're running the fund as we have before, sort of where are the attractive value opportunities, making sure we're diversified across sectors and geographies. We've got a lot of names in the fund, 100 individual names. So lots of individual shots on goal in terms of the individual change stories, so that different stocks will work better in different economic environments. But we always have the individual stories that should work irrespective of what's going on in the macro economy. And that's very much how we continue to run the fund.
Okay. And did the sell-off after the not so mini budget provide you with buying opportunities? There was a lot of volatility, clearly.
Yeah. So again, the fund generally has a sort of 3-year holding period. So we don't change dramatically when the market falls. But at the margin, it does tend to throw up more opportunities. So we tend to have a higher level of gearing after the market's fallen, and then lower that gearing again as stocks do well and we sort of sell down the winners. So both funds have had quite low levels of leverage compared to history this year. partly because we've had a lot of takeovers in the fund, and so we sold those as those have come through. But also, I think because of the uncertainty in the market, we've been keen to have sort of dry powder to invest. And we did indeed sort of over the last couple of weeks increase the gearing by about 2%. So we were about 4% geared, we're about 6% geared today. And actually most of that has gone either into the life insurance sector or also a slight increase in the oil weight in the fund. I was quite surprised by how much the oil price had come off recently, and some of the oil equities had come off. So we added to those over the last couple of weeks.
Okay. Interesting you mentioned the life insurers. You know, in the aftermath of the budget, you know, there's big falls in government bonds, and you know, it forced an intervention by the Bank of England to buy the long dated bonds to support pension funds that were feeling the strain of that fall. Have you seen any signs of forced selling by pension funds in the UK stock market?
So it's very difficult to say who, because obviously you don't get visibility on who is selling. So the markets did sell off, and I would say sold off in a reasonably indiscriminate way. But exactly what was triggering that and who was triggering that is really tough to say. I think it's clear that pension funds, because of the movements in the LDI schemes, have had to liquidate certain assets, and some of those will have liquidated equities, but just how significant an effect that's had on markets is very difficult to say.
Okay. Thinking of the economy, in your view, how stressed is the UK consumer? How bad could the recession or downturn be?
So it's a very unusual time in terms of the consumer, because if you you look at consumer confidence levels, they're at incredibly low levels. So the lowest since the survey began in the early 80s, so worse than we were seeing in the global financial crisis. But when you actually look at the consumer balance sheet and cash flow, clearly the cash flow isn't as good as it was 12 months ago. But 12 months ago, it was an all-time high. The consumer never had a better sort of growth in real income coming out of COVID, and also had significant excess savings. So the movement is definitely negative, but from a very good level. So I wouldn't say today that on average that the consumer is extremely stressed, because unemployment is still at record levels. And also a lot of the increases in energy costs, while clearly cost of petrol at the pump's gone up, the government's obviously then capped energy bills at a higher level, but not a much higher level than history. And lots of people are on 2, 3, or 5 year fixed rate mortgages. So that will be an extra cost for people over time, but not immediately today. So I would say everyone sees a negative picture for the consumer, but on the ground, actually, expenditure still at decent levels. So we do have some UK consumer plays, and trading on the ground is largely pretty flat for most of those businesses, not falling off a cliff at all.
Okay. It brings us on to the positions in banks, which you've added to, like the likes of Barclays and NatWest. Are those some of the stocks you've been adding to recently?
So we've got a lot of the fund in banks, and indeed it's the largest total sector position for the fund as a whole, about 15% of the fund. And the biggest two positions of those are NatWest and Allied Irish Bank. Those have been quite long-standing positions. More recently, we have both added to those slightly, but also significantly added to Barclays, so that is now the third biggest position. And I think the key reason why banks look more attractive now is the level of interest rates. So again, through the last decade, where interest rates have been very, very low, net interest margins for the banks have been very pressured, because effectively they have, particularly banks that have a lot of current account business, because traditionally current accounts don't pay interest. Therefore, they're a very low cost of funding. But when interest rates are zero anyway, you have all the costs of running those current accounts without really any of the benefit of that low cost funding. So you've had very low returns. The increase in interest rates we've seen is really quite transformational for the banks. So indeed, profits for NatWest have every potential to be double the level next year that they were this year. So huge moves in profitability. And that also gives the banks a very big buffer to deal with any economic downturn, because clearly that the very good payment levels that consumers have been doing and firms have been doing on their loans over the last couple of years, in a recession, you are going to see that those payments get worse. But there's a huge buffer to absorb those now. And just for example, our expectations for pre-provision profits for NatWest next year are 70% higher than they were in 2019. So effectively able to deal with a recession much better than they have done in the past.
Yeah. And thinking of the government's sort of new government's plan to minimise or ameliorate that downturn. What should the government do if it wants to boost UK economic growth to 2.5% a year? Are investment zones and lower taxes the right way to go?
So clearly, if you look at the economic textbooks, like deregulation should be good for growth. The issue is deregulation is hard and takes time. So the problem is that the government only has a couple of years till the next elections. They want to try and do things that take effect quickly. And it's really quite difficult to enact things quickly. And there's a lot of vested interest. So clearly any degree of deregulation does help over the long term. Clearly lower taxes also help with economic growth. But obviously that you need to balance the books as well. Higher levels of government debt are generally detrimental to growth. So it's a very tricky mix for the government. Everyone wants to boost economic growth. It's actually, in reality, really hard to do.
Yeah, okay. Of course. Well, let's look at some of your other holdings. Serco is your top position. That's done very well. Is it going to continue to be in a good position if the government looks to cut spending or outsource more services? Is that part of the thesis there?
So I think it's interesting how you talk about Serco there, because I think you probably just talked about it, how the average investor still views it as a primarily sort of UK-based outsourcing business. But the UK is actually only about a third of profits, and two-thirds of profits come from overseas now. And that's the real transformation that you've seen with the business under Rupert Soames. Not only did they fix the operational issues they had with some of their UK contracts, and clearly the profitability on some of those was very poor, but they've done a great job of winning more work, particularly in the US, which clearly is a much bigger market than the UK, but also a much less outsourced market. So surprisingly, given obviously the free market economics of the US, much less of government activity in the US is outsourced as a percentage than in the UK. So it's a market that has a strong organic growth. And the case also in Australia with Serco have a big business. So actually what really matters for Serco is how much the US government budget grows by and what percentage is outsourced. And that looks like it's on a structural growth trend, whereas the company's sort of priced like it's a sort of no growth UK business on about 12 times earnings. So that's where the big opportunity is here today, that the first stage of the turnaround was really delivered under the old CEO, Rupert Soames, who's recently renounced his retirement, fixing the UK. But the future story is all about that international growth.
Ah, interesting. Okay. And could you also update me on Imperial Brands? So the tobacco group is a top 10 holding. And about a year ago, you were concerned about its relative lack of progress in smokeless products compared to rival BAT. But the position is back to 3.7% according to the fact sheet. So from 2% a year ago. So are you less concerned, or what's the story there?
So the reason I cut the stock back actually wasn't about its lack of progress. It was more about the risk from the IQOS product taking off in Europe, which is Philip Morris's heated tobacco product. Because I think effectively that product, if consumers get on it, there tends to be a reasonable stickiness of those consumers, because it's quite a different experience to smoking or vaping. And that's a product that Imperial have under development, and they have in two markets, but is very nascent for them. And I was concerned that that was a risk that would make tobacco markets fall off quicker as people moved to next generation technology more quickly. Actually, what's happened since then is that product has stopped gaining market share. And there's two reasons for that. First of all, There's a computer chip in the device, and we know that there's a shortage of those computer chips, and this is quite a low ASP use of the computer chip compared to things like sort of cars or computers. So actually, they just haven't been able to roll out the product as quickly. And again, that allows Imperial, therefore, to catch up with the development of their product. And then also, particularly in Germany, which is a big market for Imperial and also something where IQOS was gaining market share, Germany has put excise tax onto heat-not-burn products at an equivalent level to smoking. So it's made it a lot more expensive to use the heat-not-burn product. And therefore, that has also stemmed the market share losses. So those are the two key things that have happened that gave me more confidence for Imperial. It allows them to have time to catch up and effectively sort of copy the leading marketeers like BAT and PMI, that those products can be developed over time. And as a number four player, that's generally what a fast follower strategy works in FMCG, very much like the CEO did at Bacardi previously. So as long as that doesn't happen quickly and you effectively get consumers entrenched on your product, I think Imperial can do well over time in next generation as well as anybody else. And the valuation's still very low. And clearly it's mainly a non-UK earning business. The UK's about 15 to 20% of the business. So again, that's been a big boost to earnings over the last year.
Yeah, fascinating. Unexpected facet of the global chip shortage. I didn't know that. Turning to Contour Global, another top holding energy company. I know very little about this. So what's more interesting about Contour Global than, say, Shell or BP?
So Contour Global's a utility business. So it's much more similar to, say, an SSE, a Drax, or parts of Centrica than it is to an oil company. And the thing that really attracted me here is that this business is about half and half renewable thermal, and it's contracted revenue. So there's no gas price risk. You effectively get a fixed price contract for 10 to 15 years for your electricity output. And on the thermal side, it's just a pass-through cost for the end customer. So a business with a lot of safety to its outcomes and trading at a massive discount to some of the renewable companies that have similar type of contracts. And I think the issue is that people were more interested in renewable pure plays than they were in mixed utilities. And they were effectively pricing the whole business at a thermal valuation, despite half of it being renewable. And to me, I thought that was a sort of unsustainable position. So the company were increasingly, what they were doing is actually recycling their assets. So selling their renewable assets at sort of 15 times EBITDA and buying new thermal ones at about 8. So the returns on capital of doing that were really good. And then ultimately what's happened is that private equity have bid for the company. And I suspect what they will do is actually split the whole company in two. So they'll invest on the renewable side and grow a big renewables company on one side, and then they'll grow a thermal company on the other side, and maybe even look to relist either of the two in future.
I see. Yeah, that sounds like would be sensible. What are you happy with the price? Because actually, I suppose it's a kind of a saving grace of your approach, is that you're buying cheap companies. If other investors don't follow you, and they can sometimes stay cheap, but then companies don't stay cheap forever, and bids and M&A come along to save the day, as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, so I think one facet of fundamentals being strong for UK companies, but valuations staying cheap, has just been the amount of M&A activity. And actually, sort of since sort of the autumn of 2020, I think we've had about 12 takeover bids in the fund now. So there's an unprecedented level. And some of them have been at really high valuations. So Contour Global was a high 30s premium, but actually a couple of bids, including the more recent RPS one, have been at 70% premium. So it just shows just how undervalued these businesses are compared to peers. Obviously, sometimes you get more opportunistic bids at lower premiums. And obviously, we don't have to accept those. If you vote against the bids and enough people follow you, then they can't happen. So that happened with VoteME. We voted against the bid. The founder tried to buy out the rest of the company at quite a low price, and that failed. Ramsay Healthcare bid for Spire, and we were quite public that was too low a price, and that went away. And then Pearson received a bid just earlier this year. We're a smaller shareholder in Pearson, so that was mainly rejected by some of the larger holders there, like Cevian. So I think, you see, I have noted other UK equity managers sort of bemoan the fact that companies are taken over. But clearly, if you have a big holding, and particularly we often own 5 or 10% of a company in mid or small cap land, you have a big say on whether that bid takes place or not. So if we don't see the value there, we don't accept offers.
Okay, so it's not really true that that UK companies are, there's a trend of UK companies getting sold off too cheaply to overseas bidders. It sounds like you have to get stuck in sometimes and fight for your stakes, fight for value. But there is a competitive situation here, and
you come up in quite big levels. Obviously, you can see. The UK is a very open equity market, and therefore if a company receives a bid, the company is then obviously open to other bids as well. And so that is the fair value of whatever people are willing to pay at the time. Or the alternative is to just keep the company quoted. So I think that, the undervaluation of the UK market, that sort of somewhere between 30 or 50% cheaper than other markets, is being shown in those takeover premium. So it's been a surprise to me that this kind of activity, especially because 80% of the earnings of the UK don't come from the UK anyway, that hasn't started to close the valuation gap versus particularly the US market or private markets. So a lot of these deals have been from US corporates or private equity, and private equity would generally take their cue in terms of valuation from the US market being the biggest global equity market.
Yeah, no. Your funds are actually quite international, more international than the UK focus might suggest. You've said that a lot of UK corporate earnings are coming from overseas, but you can also invest overseas as well, up to 30% outside the UK. Am I right?
So I think it's up to 20% we can invest overseas, right, for the mandates, and we've got about 13% in non-UK markets today. That said, despite that, When we look at how much of the earnings come from pounds, we're quite overweight compared to the index. So about 35% of the fund's earnings come from pounds compared to 20% for the index. So that's despite those overseas holdings. And that's because the more mid-small cap part of the market, where we really are overrepresented, so we've got 60% there compared to being 20% of the market, that is more domestically focused. So actually, I'd sort of say we have a structural bias to the UK compared to the index.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that. But looking at your top 10, you've got Sanofi, French pharmaceutical giant. Why is that your biggest healthcare holding?
Yeah, so particularly in sectors in the UK where the market's very concentrated, that's where we tend to use some of the overseas allowance, because basically the pharmaceutical sector in the UK is two companies at the large cap end. It's Glaxo and Astra. Whereas if you look pan-European, there's another sort of six or seven names you can choose from. And they largely have the same geographic exposure. The US is the biggest market for everybody, and Europe is much smaller. And so you're not taking any geographic risk by owning Sanofi. What I think you are getting at Sanofi is just a much lower valuation than Astra. We do have a position in Astra, but a smaller one, because the valuation is reasonable rather than great. And then Sanofi has a much better balance sheet than Glaxo. And I think also sort of less risk in terms of their portfolio, plus more growth from Dupixent, where we have quite a differentiated view. Dupixent's a large drug which Sanofi launched a couple of years ago and is growing quite strongly. So there's a strong stock-specific story overall in a company with really quite low valuation and a strong balance sheet.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you. Let's finish off going back to the gearing, the borrowing that the Special Values Trust can do. And just, what that says about your confidence in the markets and outlook. But you said that the gearing is currently 6%. I think the fact sheet says 10% gross. I don't want to get too bogged down in the technical details, but 10% gross is what. But once you include cash or something, does that bring the 10% down to 6%?
I think it's the net borrowing is actually 10% net. So you're right. What I do is where companies have got a takeover bid like Contour Global, but still in the fund, that's basically like cash because that's been agreed, that's signed and sealed, and it's going to get delivered very quickly. So we sort of count that out of the borrowing. So that's why I'm sort of looking at that 6% overall, which is a bit below what I sort of described as the neutral level of sort of 10%. And that reflects the fact that, it is a very uncertain economy today. The market is very skittish, and therefore we want to have a bit of dry powder if we see further drawdowns in the market.
Okay, but so cautious, but how positive are you for future prospective returns?
Well, I think on a 3 to 5 year view, I think there's great value in the portfolio, not just from a relative point of view, but an absolute point of view. So with the portfolio sort of earnings ratio, the price to earnings ratio is about 9. The UK market over time average is more like 12 or 13. So it's a big valuation discount versus history. And so ultimately, I think that will come through and you'll see good performance because of that. Particularly versus other markets, the US would be more like sort of 17 to 18 times earnings. So that's the key thing that makes me positive on a medium term view. I think that said, though, versus the real returns the fund's done, we've done 11.5% per annum over the first sort of 10 years. I think that level of return is an exceptionally good return. And I think it will be difficult to achieve that over time going forwards. And indeed, I think asset markets as a whole have had a really good run because low interest rates and low inflation are actually a really good cocktail for absolute returns for investors. So I think going forward, it's going to be trickier for everything. I think UK value is a place that can really outperform. But I think compared to sort of the returns we've seen from all asset classes, it will be difficult to produce those kind of returns going forward over the next 10 years.
Okay, Alex. Well, that's thanks for showing your confidence, but also moderating our expectations about what might lie ahead. Been great to talk to you. That's all we've got time for, unfortunately, but thanks very much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.